I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Despite a budget more deeply in the red than the economic ledger of any administration in history, President Bush has now proposed adding $1 trillion to the national debt in order to support a partial privatization of Social Security. The ideas in the new 417-page economic report the White House Council of Economic Advisers issued yesterday. Joining us on the line is Alicia Munell, professor of management sciences at Boston College. She's a critic of privatizing Social Security. Welcome, Professor.
Glad to be here, Bill.
Why would money, Professor, be needed to privatize Social Security? Isn't the idea here that people would manage their own Social Security benefits by investing in the market? Why would that add $1 trillion to the national debt?
Let me just step back for a moment. Social Security is running a deficit. Mm-hmm. It's promised more benefits than it's going to bring in revenues.
Right.
To fix the system is going to cost money.
Yep.
This proposal, however, fixes the system by cutting benefits first and then takes those reduced benefits and privatizes some of them. And the money that we're talking about here is the transition costs, because essentially you're taking money out of the Social Security system and putting them in individual accounts now. You need that money to pay benefits to people who are currently receiving them.
So the idea would be that the government would take money and put it in accounts that people could then use in the market, and that transitional phase will cost $1 trillion?
Yes. I mean, those are the numbers that people are referring to. You take the money out of the system now, people put them in their accounts. When they get to retirement, they'll get lower Social Security benefits and some of their retirement income from these accounts, in theory. But during this period, that money that is going into the accounts is money that's needed to pay the current beneficiaries, because, as you know, Social Security now operates mainly on as a pay-as-you-go system.
Well, what we also know, as you said, is that Social Security is in a lot of trouble. Why not try something innovative like investing in the market to make it all work?
You're right. Social Security has a shortfall. That shortfall should be fixed so that people have confidence in the program. The question is, what structure do you want the program to have? Right now, it provides what is called a defined benefit. Benefits are based on people's earnings over their lifetime, to which a benefit formula is applied. People know how much they're going to get. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter what happens to the stock market. When you talk about privatizing some of the system, you're talking about putting people's basic benefit at risk, depending on what happens to returns in equities. That doesn't seem sensible. The goal doesn't seem sensible.
Why do you think the president is sticking to his guns on this idea, given the large deficits, when this would add so much money to the national debt?
I think that he thinks this is a way to solve the Social Security problem. Privatizing in itself doesn't solve anything. And in fact, the proposal that's in the economic report of the president eliminates Social Security's entire debt by moving from something called wage indexing to price indexing, which is just a way of cutting benefits. So it solves the whole problem by cutting benefits. And then once it solves the whole problem, it goes to this private account component. And so it's not even a mechanism to solve the deficit. That's done by cutting benefits. So I think that it's a deeply held belief on his part that this is a better way to provide for retirement.
A deeply held belief, but far from a fait accompli, right? Congress would have to approve this.
Congress would have to approve this. This looked like a difficult bet even when there were surpluses at the federal level, and you could have used those surpluses to build up these individual accounts. But now that there's nothing but deficits as far as the eye can see, it makes it much more difficult.
Alicia Munell is professor of management sciences at Boston College. Professor Munell, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
Tomorrow, President Bush is expected to deliver a lengthy speech on stopping nuclear proliferation. The speech comes in the glare of the recent disclosure that Pakistan's revered leading nuclear scientist sold designs and equipment for making atom bombs to North Korea, Iran, Libya, and probably others. Joining us on the line is David Albright. He's president of the Institute for Science and International Security. He joins us from Washington, D.C. David, welcome.
Oh, good to be here.
Why do you believe the president is speaking on this issue now?
Well, I think the situation in Iraq, in a sense, has poisoned a lot of other non-proliferation efforts, and the situation in Pakistan has highlighted just how vulnerable we are and how risky the situation remains. Where here we have a Pakistan, namely an ally, and out of that ally came help to many of our enemies or foes' nuclear weapons programs. And in Iraq, there's been a failure of intelligence, and that has undermined the intelligence community's credibility and the president's credibility when it speaks about the threats posed by other countries' secret nuclear weapons programs.
Back to Pakistan for a moment. The story you're referring to is the top nuclear scientist there has been accused of pretty much launching the largest black market in nuclear materials. And as the New York Times is saying this morning in an interview with the Pakistani President Musharraf, he appears to lay part of the blame for this black market on the U.S., not sharing information with him.
Well, it's always tricky how information is shared, but I've been involved in this case of AQ Khan in Pakistan for over 15 years, and there's been plenty of information laid on the table for the Pakistani government to act, and it is typically reacted, how dare you insult our leaders and our scientists, and everything is under control. So I do think Musharraf's comment is a bit, I think, out of place.
David, what issues do you think the president has to address in his report to satisfy you?
Well, I think first he has to find a way to try to restore the credibility of U.S. intelligence. It is a very important player in the nonproliferation efforts around the world. He also does have to address this issue of Pakistan and that how do we strengthen these controls on exports and make it more international, perhaps a treaty, and then strengthen the enforcement mechanisms. We also may also need to establish in that treaty mechanism something like the International Atomic Energy Agency, maybe it would even be the International Atomic Energy Agency, that looks out for these exports and tries to figure out if bad things are happening and countries have to report to that agency. Another is, and this I worry is he'll try to reestablish this principle of preemptive military strikes. And I think that, to me, one of the things that Iraq has shown is that that policy really doesn't work. It depends on precise intelligence, which we know wasn't the case in Iraq, but also is rarely ever going to be the case. I do worry that President Bush will try to, in a new framework, reestablish that right of preemptive strikes. And I think that's a big mistake, and that we should actually move in a different direction, which is more toward international treaties, more toward international cooperation, much stronger verification, and much strengthened regime to control these dangerous exports.
Even supporters of much of the president's policy, including conservative columnist George Will, have said preemptive policy demands good intelligence.
That's right, and you rarely ever have it, and you don't want to eliminate the use of military force in your toolkit to deal with proliferation problems, but it really is a last resort, and it also there's all kinds of laws of unintended consequence that kick in that you may end up worse off in the end, and you may certainly, as we've learned in Iraq, you may shatter international coalitions, create a lot of bad feelings that make it harder to deal with other problems.
David Albright, thank you.
Thank you.
David Albright, president of the Institute for Science and International Security.
You can imagine the Republican-sponsored ad this fall should Senator John Kerry become the Democratic nominee for president and should gay marriages begin to take place in his home state of Massachusetts. Two men marrying, or two women, maybe with a backdrop of the gold-domed Massachusetts State House, with the suggestion that what's happening in Kerry's state could happen everywhere if he becomes president. Massachusetts lawmakers convene tomorrow to consider amending the state constitution to try to ban gay marriage, but this comes a week after the state's Supreme Court ruled that anything less than gay marriage creates second-class status for gay couples. To explore the dynamic politics of gay marriage in Massachusetts and the possible impact on the upcoming presidential election, we're joined now by Doug Hadaway. He's a Democratic consultant, the former spokesperson for Al Gore during the 2000 presidential campaign, and the president of Hadaway Communications. Welcome, Doug.
Hey, good to be here.
Doug, let's start with Senator John Kerry. He's in the past said that he opposes gay marriage but supports civil unions. Yet for the past week, he's been quiet on the subject. Is Kerry in a political bind?
Well, he seems to be where most voters are, supporting equal rights for gay couples under the law, drawing the line at marriage, and opposing a constitutional amendment. He has come out in opposition to amending the federal constitution to deny marriage rights to gay couples. And in fact, not talking about it a lot is actually where most people are. I think the number one thing that I've learned in all the research I've seen on this issue is that it's really not a big concern to most people. Your average sort of moderate swing voter, which is who politicians really pay attention to in election years, don't really think that much about this issue. They're worried about the economy. They're worried about American soldiers being killed overseas every day. And I frankly think George Bush is more in a bind because he's being pushed by the right wing to come out in favor of what is a rather extreme step of amending the United States Constitution to deny rights to a certain group of people.
What about that prospective ad that I suggested at the top of our conversation could be out there next fall during the campaign? Won't that rattle a lot of people?
Yeah, let me tell you about the counter ad. The ad you run on the other side shows people out of work. The voiceover says 3 million people lost their jobs since George Bush took office. Young men and women are being killed in Iraq every day. Instead of focusing on these problems, George Bush has chosen to drag the country through a long political fight over amending our Constitution to deny marriage rights to gays. What is George Bush thinking?
So what role will this play in the 2004 elections? Do you think it all might just cancel itself out?
Yeah, I think the Republicans are going to try to use it to gin up the right-wing base, which they need to do, obviously. It's going to be a close election. And they may try to peel off groups of socially conservative voters, more religiously conservative African-Americans and Catholics, and that is something the Democrats need to address. The Democrats need to make sure that they're not alienating their base either. Democratic voters support equal rights for gays. They are ambivalent about marriage. But coming out too hard and strong against gay marriage, I think, alienates an important constituency for the Democrats.
Final question, though, Doug. What about the South? If swing voters who tend to be in the middle decide elections, so do the southern states. Tennessee and Virginia, of course, primaries today. How does this cut politically in this critical southern states?
Yeah, I think it's toughest in the South. The big state up for grabs in the South is Florida, where you pretty much have a very diverse electorate that, again, is going to be focused on jobs and the economy. People in the South, like everywhere else, are focused on jobs and the economy. The Republicans will try to use this in some areas and probably sort of under the radar screen to attract more socially conservative voters. But it's tough to see how it's going to play out when people are out of work. They're worried about the cost of health care and education. So that's really the calculation that's going to be made out there in the South and everywhere.
Doug Hathaway, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Doug Hathaway is a Democratic Party strategist, the former spokesperson for Al Gore during the 2000 presidential campaign, and the president of Hathaway Communications.
Just ahead, are all medical school graduates equal? An investigative reporter says no.
And later in the show, we look at why Canada's health system appears healthier than the one in the U.S.
There's more coming up here and now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
The state of Connecticut is investigating reports that three of its hospitals accept interns from a substandard medical school in the Caribbean. The Hartford Courant reported last month that Spartan Health Sciences University on the Caribbean island of St. Lucia has such a bad reputation that its graduates can't even be licensed on St. Lucia and are also banned from practicing in six American states, but they've been accepted in Connecticut and elsewhere. And there's a broader issue claimed by the Courant's eight-month investigation. Two additional foreign schools and two American institutions produce problematic doctors at a rate 10 times higher than other med schools. Joining us on the line is Hartford Courant reporter Jack Dolan. And Jack, to the Connecticut hospitals first, why would they even be looking to foreign medical schools for interns?
It gets to an issue of the prestige of hospitals. It is sort of a truism in medicine that large teaching hospitals are better. And what happens is some of these smaller hospitals would like to be known as teaching hospitals. Mm-hmm. In order to do that, you have to be able to attract residents who, you know, are fully licensed graduates of medical schools. In order to have residents in your hospital, you have to have students for them to teach. And that's how Spartan students wind up in these Connecticut hospitals.
Okay. And we understand that U.S. medical schools produce 3,000 fewer graduates, these licensed residents, a year than are needed at hospitals. So they have to go overseas.
Right.
When we say that Spartan is substandard, what do you mean?
It's a single building. It's got about four rooms, one lab, three what seemed to me fairly musty old cadavers. Right. I was shown them.
And students who, I mean, you spoke to one student who said he just can't wait to get a knife on somebody.
Yeah. He said it twice, actually, in about 5 minutes that we spoke. You know, Caribbean medical schools as a group have the reputation of being places that you go if you can't get into schools in the U.S. I don't think I talked to anybody who claimed that they had done well on the MCATs, which is sort of like the SATs for medical school. The student who couldn't wait to get a blade on somebody said that he had taken them, I think, twice, did terribly both times, but he said he went down to Spartan because, as he said, he just couldn't wait to get a blade on someone and figured that was the quickest route.
Yeah. Well, let's broaden out your investigation as you did. You also found that there were four schools, two foreign, two American, that produced most of the problematic, as in most disciplined, doctors in the U.S., and they include the Autonomous University of Guadalajara in Mexico, Manila Central University in the Philippines, but also Howard University in Washington, D.C., and is it Meharry Medical College in Nashville?
Right.
Howard, in particular, it's a school primarily for African-Americans that's held up as being a good school.
Right. Both Howard and Meharry are traditionally black schools. First of all, the administrations of both schools did not speak to us. But other people we spoke to in the medical community explained it this way. 20, 30 years ago, if you were, you know, a young, bright black kid and you wanted to become a doctor, you went to Howard or you went to Meharry, period. Now, you know, if you're that kid and you've got a 4.0, you know, you go to Johns Hopkins, you go to Harvard. There is opportunity for you. As a sort of unintended consequence of that, the students who end up being accepted at Howard and Meharry are no longer the cream of that crop. And it's not just our analysis that shows that. They've had this brain drain going on.
We should say that, as you well know, there have been critics of your report. The head of the American Association of Medical Colleges called it simplistic and foolish and says, I don't think there are any bad medical schools in the U.S. Others have said that when it comes particularly to U.S. schools, Howard and Meharry, that doctors of color may be more likely to get disciplinary action than whites, somewhat skewing the results. But how did you come to your conclusions?
What we did was, first we looked out at the state of California, which has a great database of physician profiles. These profiles contain, you know, the physician's name, where they went to school, and whether any disciplinary action has been taken against them. And what we simply did was we ranked the schools by the percentage of graduates who have gone on to face disciplinary action from a state board. Now, this is different from a malpractice case where, you know, you're going up in front of a jury who may or may not be sympathetic to a patient who had a bad outcome. These are your peers. These are fellow doctors who sit on the licensing board who are generally quite loath to make sort of knee-jerk, you know, conclusions that a doctor did something wrong. We did that in California, we did that in Ohio, and we did it with a national database compiled by Public Citizen that had every doctor disciplined in any state in the country during the 1990s. Mm-hmm. And in each of those analyses, separate analyses over, you know, long periods of time, decades, each time, the Autonomous University of Guadalajara, Howard Meharry, and Manila Central consistently showed up in the top four or five positions.
Well, what are we running up against here? You know, as you know, others have told you that these schools offer a terrific opportunity for those willing to work hard, and that, in fact, the time that they serve in their residency, and in other words, when they actually get into a hospital, sort of evens out the playing field.
The people that I spoke with were generally of the opinion that there is only so much academic remediation a medical school can do. The question of whether you take a kid who did not do particularly well in his freshman or in sophomore years of college, but then turned it around, you know, you're giving them an opportunity. Personally, I think that's a great thing. But what our analysis shows is that those students tend to go on to screw up and harm patients at a higher rate than the students who got into more prestigious medical schools.
You know, we're going to hear from people who went to Howard who are wonderful doctors.
Well, I mean, there was nothing in our series that said that you could not become a great doctor if you went to any of these schools. I mean, it doesn't mean that you are necessarily a bad doctor, but it does raise the question of whether the schools are adequately preparing people. Otherwise, it's hard to explain our findings.
And it sounds as if the question isn't really whether they're adequately preparing them, but whether they're accepting the right students in the first place.
That was the one thing that we found that all these schools had in common.
Well, Jack, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Jack Dolan, co-reporter for the Hartford Courant's series on banned schools and bad medicine. To read the series, go to our website, here-now.org.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, lawmakers in Massachusetts weigh changing the state's constitution to prohibit gay marriage. We look at the political struggle underway in the state.
And we look back at the 1918 killer flu. That's tomorrow.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
How's this for a novel of exotic political intrigue? A country's president is becoming increasingly imperial, his opponents say, taking on more and more power for himself, threatening democracy. Then, one of his chief rivals in the upcoming presidential election disappears. City police open a murder investigation, which federal police promptly block. Then, as mysteriously as he disappeared, the missing presidential candidate reappears. Not bad, huh? Well, it's the real world and still unraveling plot of presidential elections scheduled for this March 14th in Russia. Joining us from Moscow is David Filipov, reporter for the Boston Globe. Welcome, David.
Thanks for having me.
David, thanks for joining us. Just this morning, word now that Ivan Rybkin, the man in question, has reappeared, David. He's one of several people running against Vladimir Putin for president of Russia. Who's Ivan Rybkin and what's the latest on where he was and where he is now?
Well, he's a former Speaker of Parliament, a former Secretary of the Security Council, former very important person who in recent years has become a lot less of a prominent politician, but a loud critic of Vladimir Putin. Right now, he apparently is on a plane from Kiev to Moscow that will land here in another, well, I guess it will land in a couple of hours, alive and well, and he professes to be entirely amazed at the controversy swirling about his disappearance.
Huh. Well, how long was he missing?
He left Thursday, I believe Thursday night. That was the last time anyone saw him. His wife assumed he'd gone to their suburban residence here in Moscow, and on Sunday reported him missing. Now he's saying essentially that he basically wanted to get away from it all for a few days, got on a train and went to Kiev, turned off his telephone, and was amazed to find out that people were worried about him.
Former Kremlin insider and billionaire businessman Boris Berezovsky, David, as you know, is entangled in this. He's an arch opponent of Putin, and he's a big supporter of the formerly missing Rybkin. Putin supporters say Berezovsky staged all this as a political stunt. Is anybody buying that?
Well, the main thing that anyone says about Boris Berezovsky anymore is that he's staging something for a political stunt. Berezovsky used to be a very powerful man. His influence has waned considerably since Putin came to power. He's in exile in Britain. And about all he can do is try to stir the pot. And a lot of people thought that Ripken's disappearance might be some sort of plot to just draw attention to the fact that there are other candidates out there and that the process is flawed and that it's not a fair election.
One thing that's for sure in Russia, David, is that President Vladimir Putin is enormously popular and expected to sail to re-election. Why is that, given that the Russian economy is not all that great, Chechen terrorism continues, Russia's certainly not been restored to its former glory on the world stage? Why is he so popular, just to finish up?
Putin is popular because he gives Russians the feeling that someone is in charge after all those years of distant, effete communist leaders. And one of the things he's been able to do is minimize the amount of political scandals that appear in Russia. And so the disappearance of Ripken, a guy who incidentally had no chance of beating Putin, he didn't have a chance of getting 5% of the vote, was the first sort of disruption of Putin's sort of orderly campaign image in this election. And if that were the intent of the people who designed this disappearance, then in that they have succeeded.
David Filipov is a reporter for the Boston Globe based in Moscow. He joined us from there. David, thanks very much.
Thanks a lot.
The American healthcare system, for all its faults, it's the best in the world, right? Well, an impressive array of studies shows that though Americans spend a lot on healthcare, they're not getting their dollars worth. Our neighbor to the north, Canada, has a system which seems to be much more effective at making and keeping people healthy. Joining us to talk about the Canadian healthcare model is our regular health commentator, Judy Foreman. Judy, what kinds of studies are we talking about?
Oh, there are lots. You could drown in the statistics. The World Health Organization keeps track. So does the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. Lots of groups keep track of these big population-based numbers.
And what do they measure?
Well, for one thing, they measure life expectancy. They measure infant mortality, maternal mortality around the time of childbirth, and a lot of other things, which give you different glimpses into the healthcare system.
Well, but as you write in your column, and we'll tell people how they can read it, life expectancy isn't really a good measure of healthcare.
That's right. Life expectancy is one measure, and by that measure, Canadians do a lot better than we do. Their life expectancy is about 79.8 years, and ours is 77.3. That's a good couple years difference. In fact, they rank fifth in the world in life expectancy, and we rank 26th. Mm-hmm. So that's a big difference. But that doesn't take account of a lot of things that people die of and hence bring down the numbers. In this country, we shoot each other a lot with guns.
Yeah.
We have the highest homicide rate in the world, and we have a lot of illegal drug use and a lot of other things like that. People who don't use seatbelts, people who take other risks with their lives, which cause earlier deaths and therefore make the life expectancy figure lower.
Well, when you limit it to just health care system and just those factors, if you can, what is it about their health care system that is supposed to make them healthier?
A lot of people would argue that it's their single-payer system, that everybody's covered and they have universal access. And we don't. We have millions and millions of people who don't have health insurance at all. So we have a very unbalanced system. For the rich people, it's pretty good. For the rest of people, it's not good at all.
Well, we've had this conversation before on this program, and what always comes up in this discussion is the yes buts. You know, yes, but Canada has huge taxes to pay for that single-payer system. And the things that are at the high end of health care, like MRIs, you know, the more extreme costly care, you can't get in Canada.
I don't know if that's exactly right. There have traditionally been longer waits for things like that in Canada, but what people tell me is that those waits are getting shorter, that, you know, that discrepancy is less big than it used to be.
And what about the tax question? What about the cost of the Canadian system?
Oh, in overall cost, they pay much less than we do. On average, per capita, they pay a little over $2,000 a year, and we pay close to $5,000. So they are getting a lot more for their money than we are.
They pay less than half, and they're healthier.
That's right, and they live longer.
But again,
and also, another important way to gauge these two healthcare systems, if you look at infant mortality and maternal mortality, that's, in a way, better than life expectancy as a measure, because that's where your medical care really plays a role. and they do much better than we do. The U.S. infant mortality rate is about 6 deaths per 100,000 women. In Canada, it's 5. That may not sound like a lot of difference, but it really is. And in terms of maternal mortality, they do much better. We lose about 9, almost 10 women per 100,000 in childbirth or around that time, and they lose only 3.4. So that's a huge difference, and that does get at how well people are being taken care of by the system.
And again, you factor in lifestyle and the way people live, but boy, it seems like an interesting topic and an interesting finding in a presidential election year.
You would hope so.
Judy, thank you.
Thank you.
Syndicated columnist and Here Now's regular health commentator Judy Foreman. To read her column on healthcare in Canada, go to our website, here-now.org.
You're listening to Here and Now.
As the Democratic candidates make their way through the primaries today in Tennessee and Virginia, hundreds of cameras will be trailing them. One may have a unique vantage point. Alexandra Carey is the 30-year-old daughter of Democratic frontrunner Senator John Carey. She's also a former actress with a bit part in 1999 Spartan and a budding filmmaker who's been documenting Dad. We talked with her during a break on the campaign trail and asked how the project came about.
It just grew out of the fact that I am a film student right now. So I obviously it's such a unique situation that capturing it on camera seemed sort of like an obvious response to what was going on.
It's a documentary filmmaker's dream, but it's also a nightmare because you're not truly independent. You're the daughter of the candidate.
Exactly, which is something I'm constantly negotiating and trying to figure out as I go through the process. And there are moments that I just feel instinctually. My dad sometimes is tired and will say, you know, I don't want the camera on me, you know, just because he has cameras on him all the time. So we'll make jokes about that. And then, you know, there's just great moments in the bus. Some things around Christmas, we did a sort of Secret Santa thing with the press, and it was very fun. And
what was that, Secret Santa?
That was in Iowa when my father did the 24-hour bus tour, and it was about 3 in the morning, and one of the campaign workers performed James Brown in the bus over the loudspeaker, and then we played Secret Santa gift-giving session with all of the press, and I have that on the camera.
Secret Santa, is that, you know, where people exchange, like one person, you pulled a name out?
Yeah, actually, my sister called it a Yankee swap. It's where you pick out of a hat and then you trade different gifts.
Right.
Probably doesn't sound very exciting to many people, but at 3 in the morning in Iowa, I'll tell you it was fun.
Alexandra, is it possible to really capture capture what's real in these campaigns after some of the classic films have been made? I'm thinking of The War Room and others. And with the crowded field now who are turning their cameras on the candidates, have you ever seen Alexandra Pelosi's documentary? She's the daughter of Nancy Pelosi, the House Minority Whip.
Yeah, Journeys with George. I've seen pieces of it. I haven't seen the entire thing, actually. I've seen The War Room and actually was really intrigued with how much access they had.
Well, Alexandra's documentary, as you said, it's called Journeys with George. It was her traveling with the then Texas governor presidential candidate on the campaign trail. It's gotten raves.
Yeah, I heard that he was very charming, actually.
She apparently also was looking for a Democratic candidate to start filming as they go on in this year's election. And Drew Barrymore, the actress, is out making her own documentary of the Democratic candidates. I'm just, you know, the field seems to get kind of crowded.
Well, I'm sure it is. I mean, I think by nature of the fact that I am the daughter, that there could be an interesting story there that obviously is a unique perspective.
I'm sure you've looked ahead. You are potentially the next first daughter of the United States. It's a wide open field right now, but you're one of the candidates for that role.
I know. The way you make it sound, it has such daunting.
Well, are you daunted?
You know, I really have focused on this as a process, to tell you the truth. I mean, I think that it's more grounding. And also, as we've seen, you really don't know what tomorrow brings. So I really feel like in some sense, I would be getting ahead of myself to start seeing things in that vein. So I look towards the next primaries and towards finishing my thesis film. And we'll see. You can ask me that same question in about 5 months if we're still in the race. And I'm sure I'll have a very different answer.
If nothing else, you have a very well-done home movie.
Yeah, exactly.
Alexandra, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Alexandra Carey, on filming her father, Senator John Carey, on the campaign trail.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
When the upstate New York sensation 10,000 Maniacs came on the national scene in the mid-80s, their music rejuvenated folk rock and became a staple in dorm rooms. In 1995, lead singer Natalie Merchant set off on a solo career.
Ooh, jealousy.
Now, fans of both the group and the woman at its center can enjoy two new CDs, Campfire Songs, the popular, obscure, and unknown recordings of 10,000 Maniacs, and Natalie's solo effort, The House Carpenter's Daughter, a collection of traditional and contemporary folk music.
Come here, ladies and gentlemen, and listen to my song. Play it to your right, but you may think it wrong. May make you mad, but it means no harm. Just about the run of song, Penny Strong. This is a hot time in the culture, at on Penny Strong.
Natalie Merchant plans a small solo tour this summer, but at the moment, she's caring for her baby daughter and living a quiet life back home in upstate New York, or vacationing in Hawaii, where we've reached her. Natalie, hello.
Hello.
Well, before we get to the new CD, many of your fans are so excited about the two CD set from Rhino Records. It's again called Campfire Songs, the popular, obscure, and unknown recordings of 10,000 Maniacs. What was that like for you? Because I know you were very involved in putting it together, to go back over all those songs.
Well, it was a good opportunity to gather together a lot of the B-sides and recordings that were made for compilations or benefit records or live recordings that have been sort of scattered and difficult to obtain.
The little orphans, so to speak. Well, of course, the popular ones we know, Trouble Me, Because the Night, What's the Matter Here?
I'm tired of the excuses everybody uses. Is their head. I stay out of it.
These Are Days, that went right to number one. But as the title also suggests, there are the lesser known and the hard to find songs, as you said, the B-sides. Mention one that you'd want us to hear.
Well, when we did the MTV Unplugged, David Byrne was our special guest, and we did Dallas, which was sung by Jimmy Dale Gilmore, but we also did Let the Mystery Be by Iris DeMent. And that was only released as a benefit for Rock the Vote when Clinton was running for office, so that's going back a few years.
Everybody's wondering what and where we all came from. Everybody's worried about when they're gonna go and the whole thing's done.
But as I said, that was then and this is now, and you have a new solo CD out. It's called The House Carpenter's Daughter. On your own record label, it's a cover of traditional and contemporary folk music, and as you write in the liner notes, that was initially hard for you to define.
Right. I remember a couple of years ago I was taking some time off, and I took a history of American folk music and dance class. And I remember a debate that we kept going back to was, how do you exactly define American folk music? And our teacher thought that jazz, blues, and swing was American folk music. He said that it was any music that defined a culture and identified the people. Well, it was kind of where the debate would always end. Because a lot of people think of traditional folk music as having to be played on acoustic instruments and having to be ballad, archaic language. And some people are very militant about the way that the form has to be preserved and the way that the songs have to be presented. But I liked his flexible interpretation of it.
And as you say, it's as simple as enduring the test of time. Mm-hmm. And making itself useful to us. That's a good definition.
Yeah.
Well, I weep and I moan and I move slowly on. I'm a poor morning pilgrim bound for Canaan land.
You have always felt to me sort of a connection with the sort of the Pete Seeger, Hudson River, I'm thinking of the author William Kennedy, Ironweed, kind of tied to the land kind of person, probably even when you were four. Have you always felt, I don't know what the word is, a traditionalist?
Well, I was raised in the 60s and 70s. My childhood happened, and probably the first folk music I ever heard would probably sound better to say that it was Peter, Paul, and Mary, but I'm sure it was probably the theme from the Beverly Hillbillies was the first bluegrass I ever heard.
See, here I am thinking Natalie Merchant, she's always had this connection with the past. You've always, that's how it's, you know.
Well, I'm just saying that's the environment that I grew up in. It almost felt like sometimes the pop culture that surrounded me and that was coming at me was at odds with my immediate surrounding, because I spent most of my time as a child in the forest, you know, playing.
And upstate New York has that particular, it's one of my favorite places, and it has that particular sense of fading away.
Yeah, definitely. I spent half my childhood in Jamestown, which was an industrial town that was fading away, for sure, definitely in the 70s. Mm.
I guess that's what I feel in the CD, sort of a need to preserve. And let's hear another song. This one is called Soldier, Soldier. It's different from some of the other songs in its tempo. I understand from your writing, it's a song from the South, and kids used to jump rope to it.
Said soldier now, soldier, won't you marry me?
I just heard this on, I think it was an Alan Lomax field recording that was made back in the 50s.
I'm there, such a pretty little girl, and I got no suit to put on. Well, she went to the Dogwood store, hard as she could run. She bought the finest little suit in the store. Come on, soldier, put this on.
Natalie Merchant's Soldier, Soldier on her new CD, The House Carpenter's Daughter. I want to point out as well that fans of the great Sandy Denny will be pleased to hear that you cover her version of Crazy Man Michael. It's more recent folk, written by Richard Thompson when they were both in the Fairport Convention. Mm-hmm. What appealed to you about that song? I mean, of all the contemporary songs you could have picked, why that one?
I remember when I joined 10,000 Maniacs, one of the guitar players, John Lombardo, was a huge Fairport Convention Sandy Denny fan, and he gave me all his Fairport records to make cassettes of. And Crazy Man Michael is always that, and Matty Groves were my favorite songs.
Who is in the fire in Lollipop's heat? Crazy Man Michael was walking.
All these songs, there's no academic, you know, justification for the selection of songs on the record, and this, you know, it's emotional, and it's the songs that had some personal meaning to me or that I responded to when I was doing research. It really is just songs I like.
Your future, you often have asked me. Your true love will die by your own right hand. And crazy man Michael will curse it.
The big reason why this project came about is it wasn't really to make an album. It was my guitar player, Eric Delapen, and I were always backstage trying to play music together. And whenever we would try to do something traditional, we'd find that our knowledge just didn't overlap, and it was really patchy.
So, everybody has that experience. Everybody, let's sing Irene Goodnight, and you can sing the first line, and then you can't.
And we'd always end up doing a Beatles cover or something, or a Dylan song. And I just said, this is pathetic. We have to do something about this. I want to be able to sing this music and sing it with you. So that's how we did the research and came up with a repertoire. And then we just went with, well, we should go in the studio and just make some kind of record of this, record of it, not make a record. And then the tapes just sounded so good that I didn't want them just, you know, sitting in my garage, which is what they were doing.
And we're wayfaring stranger.
Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot.
Natalie Merchant, her new CD is called The House Carpenter's Daughter. In addition, Rhino Records has also just released Campfire Songs, the popular, obscure, and unknown recordings of 10,000 Maniacs. For more information, go to our website, here-now.org.
Well, I'm going back to meet my mother. Said she'd meet
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
Get into your radio.
And join us again here and now.
And no dark clouds will gather round me, and I know my way be the steep.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.